Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, President Joe Biden delivered a fiery State of the Union speech to Congress last night, highlighting his accomplishments, sharpening his differences with Republicans on issues ranging from abortion rights to taxing corporations, and promising to defend democracy at home and abroad.
My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th.
The president also announced that the U.S. military would build a temporary port off the shore of Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid to desperate Palestinians caught in Israel's war against Hamas. We'll get reaction and some analysis of what was one of Biden's most important speeches ever. That's next after this news. This is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Mina Kim. Well, President Biden delivered his State of the Union address last night before Congress and millions of people watching on television. And with questions about Biden's age and his ability to wage a vigorous campaign for re-election against former President Donald Trump, the president delivered a feisty address, repeatedly referring to his predecessor without naming him.
My predecessor failed the most basic presidential duty that he owes to American people, the duty to care. I think that's unforgivable.
Republicans criticized the speech as too political, rarely applauding and occasionally shouting at him. They asked 42-year-old Alabama Senator Katie Britt to give the party's official response from her kitchen. She noted that Biden has been in office longer than she's been alive and questioned his ability to be commander-in-chief. Well, joining us now to analyze the president's performance and the contents of his speech, along with the reaction, are Ro Khanna, who joins us from Washington, D.C. He's the U.S. congressman representing California's 17th congressional district in Silicon Valley. Congressman, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Christopher Catalago, California bureau chief for Politico and a former White House correspondent. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us, Catherine Lucy, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to you as well.
Great to be here.
Let me begin with you, Congressman, because you were there last night in the House chamber. There was a long windup to that speech. The president took his time walking down the aisle and afterwards as well. What did it feel like to be there?
That was high energy. The president really knocked it out of the park. It's one of the strongest speeches I've heard him give. I think he's best when he is fighting, and it was clear that he's fighting for American values. He's fighting to get funding for Ukraine. He's fighting for a middle class and working class agenda. Democrats left energized, and candidly, there were some murmurings before the speech of, is he up to the job? And he definitively answered it.
Was it a sense of relief as much as anything?
I think there was actually excitement. I mean, I think people really found the speech inspiring. It was forward-looking. His best passage was at the end where he said, look, I used to be the youngest member of the Senate. Now I'm one of the older people. But ultimately, it's about one's values, and my values haven't changed. I believe America needs to be inclusive and decent and not hate-filled and compassionate. And it's really two stark different visions for America. And the president's going to fight with everything he has to keep Trump out of the White House.
Chris Catalago, what about you? What stood out as you listened to the speech and watched it?
Yeah, I think that one of the big things we saw in the speech was there was no pivot. There was no reset from Biden. This is very much Biden amplifying and pushing forward with a lot of the themes that we've seen both from the White House and the campaign, looking to get more attention. He's going to go on the road now and make several battleground stops following the speech to shine attention both on the record and what he wants to do. The other thing that really stood out is just the contrast that he made between his administration and the Trump administration and what Trump would want to do in office. And I think that's really something that they've leaned into hard that was maybe not there for a lot of his time in the White House. You would see him come forward, say, in the midterms and make that argument, and then they would sort of recede and drop it and not come back to that contrast. There was a whole early period in his presidency where they never mentioned Trump, and you didn't really see them start mentioning him until the Virginia governor's race in 21. And so this is a start of the clock, clearly on the general, but also there've been a lot of Democrats calling for the White House to lean into that contrast much harder than they have been. And there was really kind of a fighting spirit there that folks in the party have wanted to see from Biden.
And Catherine Lucey, he began this speech not with domestic policy, but with foreign policy, going right to the Ukraine war, kind of drawing a parallel with FDR and his speech to Congress in 1941, saying this was no common moment, that this was really an extraordinary moment. What did you make with that choice of opening right up with the Ukraine war?
That makes sense. I mean, the president, I think, as everyone is saying, he really came in swinging. He wanted to show that he was fighting, and he really wanted to show that he was fighting not just for his presidency, but for specific things. And this idea of protecting democracy at home and abroad has really been a central focus for him throughout his presidency. He has been trying to get Congress to approve more aid for Ukraine. That has not been successful so far. And you saw him push Republicans in the room throughout the speech, but he really opened with this, pushing them for more aid, declaring that history is watching, if the United States will do this, saying that if the U.S. won't, that Ukraine will be at risk. So he really wanted to send that message early, I think, and make the argument that it's not just a conflict abroad, that it is about American values and what is next for the U.S. and the U.S.'s role in the world.
Well, and so much of this was campaign-like in that he was contrasting himself with the former president. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to say about Donald Trump and Putin.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable.
Chris Catalogo, how do you think that whole notion lands, you know, where you're really contrasting? I mean, in some ways, we've gotten so used to Trump saying outrageous things and siding with Trump over his own national security advisors, that kind of thing. Is it still have a, you know, still pack a punch with voters, do you think?
The question of how foreign policy in general plays with voters versus domestic policy has been one that's been asked, frankly, since that conflict started. It's something that the administration takes a lot of pride in, the Biden administration, in rallying the world and rallying NATO. They see it as tied in and linked closely with the themes of Biden's domestic policy in terms of defending democracy, both here and abroad. And so if he can make that direct connection to folks on the importance of this, on the fact that they're fighting for more money for Ukraine. Now, of course, there's the conflict in Gaza, and that adds another layer of complexity to the whole situation. But his point, I think, is that these things happening around the world, our involvement, our leadership matters. And Trump, if elected, is going to basically throw out the window and go in the complete opposite direction. And so in that sense, it does relate to the campaign. It can find some salience with voters, maybe beyond ways that foreign policy has in the past.
Congressman Khanna, you were in Michigan recently talking to voters. Michigan, of course, has a large population of Arab Americans who are very upset with the way Biden has given what they see as Israel sort of unfettered options in its war with Hamas. What did you make of his comments last night? And in particular, this idea that he's going to have the U.S. military build a temporary pier or port offshore from Gaza to bring humanitarian aid there.
I think it was a welcome shift in the president's tone and in the administration's policies. I was texting with a few of the people I know in Dearborn, and they said that this president probably gave the most detailed empathy for Palestinian lives that we've heard a modern president do, and that was appreciated. Of course, we need more policy changes. I believe we need a permanent ceasefire with the release of all hostages. And I think the president needs to hold Netanyahu to account and stop transferring weapons if Netanyahu doesn't stop firing at the food convoys to deliver the trucks. But this was a speech that I think really helped the president win back some trust from voters who've been really concerned about the heartbreaking loss in Gaza.
Catherine Lucey, what would you add to that? The president did not call for a permanent ceasefire or even an immediate ceasefire that might be temporary, although we know behind the scenes that's what they're negotiating for. Do you see it as a real pivot point here going forward?
Yeah, we know obviously that he has been looking for a humanitarian pause, and they've been trying to get some kind of temporary ceasefire before the start of Ramadan, which comes next week. That doesn't seem to be happening. Hamas pulled out of those talks yesterday. And I think you saw in the chamber and outside the Capitol just how hot this issue is within the party. There were protesters outside the Capitol, seated in the street, holding up signs, calling for a ceasefire. So I think the congressman is right. The president is trying to make clear what he is trying to do to address the humanitarian needs. They are looking to install this temporary pier, get more supplies in. But these folks are going to want to see more in the policy space and I think really working towards a pause or a temporary ceasefire is really key for the president moving forward, and his folks know that.
One of the key focuses that the president made on domestic policy, of course, was on abortion. There were members of the U.S. Supreme Court right there, and he did not hesitate to call them out. Let's hear a little bit about what he had to say on that.
Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away? Look, it's a decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court majority wrote the following, and with all due respect, justices, women are not without electoral or political power. You're about to realize just how much you were right about that.
Chris Catalago, we're coming up to a break, but just quickly, were you surprised? I mean, it's interesting that the Supreme Court, including Justice Roberts and Gorsuch, were there kind of sitting stone-faced, including the Democratic-appointed justices, but he kind of took it to them, didn't he?
Yeah, I think you're seeing kind of a subtle evolution of Biden here. The institutionalist is recognizing that our politics have changed. The times have changed. You saw some statements from him, even post-Dobbs, where he was talking about this extreme decision from the court. That is not the approach that the old Biden from the Senate Judiciary Committee likely would have used. Yeah. And so, this was a speech for the moment and not one from the old Biden canon.
All right. More to come. Join us if you would. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Tell us what you thought of the speech and the Republican reaction. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees. who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this hour for Mina Kim. We're talking about last night's State of the Union speech from President Joe Biden and the Republican reaction to it. We're talking with Ro Khanna, congressman who represents the 17th Congressional District, Silicon Valley. Also, Christopher Catalago, California Bureau Chief for Politico, and Catherine Lucy, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Tell us what you thought. What did you like? What did you not like? What was missing from the speech or the reaction from Republicans? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can reach us by email if you like. It's forum@kqed.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all the social media channels. We're at KQED Forum. Here's a comment from Steve who writes on Discord. I know the liberal and progressive audience will generally approve and find much to like. I know the conservative and far right will disapprove and find little to like. My curiosity and concern is in the middle, the undecided and swing voters. How did they react? Do we know if any substantial number of them see or hear anything to convince them or strongly incline them either way? Chris, what do you think about that? Do these audiences tend to sort of, trend toward the party in power? In other words, more Democrats watched last night and more Republicans would have watched with a Republican president?
Yeah, I think this is where certainly that tends to be the case, especially folks who weigh in after that. It is the folks most energized and in the president's party. But I think for those folks who may have some doubts, this is probably where the performance aspect of the speech from Biden standing up there for 67 minutes. I mean, you could be in your 20s or 30s or 40s and ask yourself, could I do that? Right. And you're looking at Biden doing it. And so for folks who see snippets of Biden maybe eating the ice cream cone, for a few minutes on TikTok and answering a question about Israel in that moment, or, they see selectively edited clips here or there. Watching larger clips of this speech, I think, could go a long way for them assessing where he stands and whether they think he's up to the job.
Congressman Khanna, one of the big issues that voters say they're concerned about is the border and immigration, border security. And of course, there was a bipartisan effort to Democrats basically gave everything Republicans said they wanted, and the Republicans wouldn't take yes for an answer. I want to play a short clip from last night of the president calling out Republicans and then come back to you and get your reaction.
In November, my team began serious negotiation with a bipartisan group of senators. The result was a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border security reforms we've ever seen. Oh, you don't think so? Oh, you don't like that bill, huh? That conservatives got together and said it was a good bill? I'll be darned. That's amazing.
A little bit of ad-libbing, I guess, from the president there. Congressman, what do you make of the immigration and border issue? Because it is a tough one. The Democrats own it in the sense that he is president. It's also, you have Latino voters, including, you have Senator Alex Padilla, who are very concerned about all the concessions that the president, the White House, was willing to make to get this done. How do you see it playing out in terms of what can be done between now and November to really convince voters who are on the fence that Biden can get this under control?
Though the president was very effective in the clip you played, and there is a clip of Senator Lankford, a Republican, saying it's the truth. I mean, he basically was confirming President Biden's view that President Biden was trying to solve this issue. He was willing to compromise beyond even what he wanted for a Republican put together bill. And then Donald Trump sunk it because he wants the issue. And the president said, look, instead of arguing about how to fix the border, why don't we just fix the border, have common sense in terms of more border patrol agents, making sure people are vetted or coming in. But at the same time, he said, look, this is an immigrant nation. This is a nation where immigrants have contributed to our economy, to our culture. And I'm not going to astray from those fundamental values. And that certainly is, in my view, what will resonate with the vast majority of Americans.
Catherine Lucy, what would you add to that? Last night, Of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene was there with her red MAGA hat, and she was making an issue as the president walked in about the murder of a 22-year-old nursing student in Georgia by a Venezuelan man who was in the country illegally. And the president kind of ad-libbed a little bit. He kind of misspoke the name of that nursing student. But in general, what do you make of how the Biden administration is trying to address this issue and kind of turning it on Republicans who rejected the compromise that they were ready to accept?
Well, a couple of things. I do think the president and the White House really are trying to put the pressure back on Republicans on this issue. The president was at the border last week. He and Trump were down there sort of doing dueling visits on the same day. And he's making the argument that he made last night, that he's prepared to try and work on this, that he had a bipartisan deal, and a deal that, you know, gave Republicans a lot of things that they ostensibly wanted and that they did not sign on to, you know, and that Trump opposed. And even in that moment with Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think you saw the president trying to, you know, show that he is prepared to engage on this. So, you know, they a lot of Republicans, some Republicans in the room were wearing buttons that said, "Say her name." And the president, he said her name, although he appeared to mispronounce it, but he did, you know, say her name and, you know, called her an innocent woman who was killed. He did then say she was killed by an illegal, which has drawn criticism from immigration advocates, but he addressed her parents. He said his heart went out to them. So it saw that he clearly was prepared to engage on that and is not trying to duck on that issue.
Congressman Khan, I know you have to go, but before I let you go, I want to ask you about the jobs report out this morning. It showed very robust new jobs, I think 270,000 new jobs, and yet people are still not feeling positive about Biden's handling of the economy. What do you make of this, both the report out today and people's lack of willingness to give Biden any credit?
I think the president made a very strong case that his policies, the CHIPS Act, the IRA, Inflation Reduction Act, American Rescue Plan, has gotten us to a place where inflation is coming down, where there's been record job creation. But he should take a page out of FDR's book and say, look, we've made progress, but the working class, the middle class are still hurting. Rents are too high. Groceries are too high. The jobs were being created. Some of them are part-time jobs. They're still not paying enough. And that's why we have a lot of work to do. And that's what I think you heard the president do last night. He said, we've done a lot, but we've got a lot of work to do. Here's my future looking agenda. And by the way, FDR was blaming Herbert Hoover even in his fourth term. So I'm glad that the president is casting the blame on Donald Trump. And so I think he thread the needle last night and really has inspired a lot of Democrats who, candidly, there was some concern, but I think he really answered it last night with a positive looking vision. One last point. He did use the words immediate ceasefire in his speech last night for 6 weeks. And that's important because I think that was a signal that he's listening to a lot of people around the country who have a concern about what's happening in Gaza.
All right. Congressman Ro Khanna, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And let's bring in one more guest. Mike Madrid is a Republican strategist joining us this morning from Sacramento. Mike Madrid, welcome.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Should also say that you were a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, which is a group that Republicans that tried to prevent the election of Donald Trump and now the re-election of Donald Trump. In that regard, what did you make of, well, let me ask you, you know, the big visual, of course, was Mike Johnson, the new speaker, sitting there next to Vice President Kamala Harris. And he appeared, he just never really stood up except maybe one time to applaud. What did you make of the whole theatrics of that and what it says about the state of this Republican Party right now?
Look, that's a great question. It was something I was noticing as well, Scott, because usually when you have people of different parties standing or sitting rather behind the president, there are at least a handful of times where somebody will get up and just out of professional protocol or good manners, you know, softly clap to show that there's a united country here. I think Mike Johnson was being, you know, the eyes agaze from his side of the aisle to prevent him from standing for almost everything. I think there was the one time he did stand when it was when the president mentioned that we would be standing with Israel. And I think he even stalled then, was like, is it okay to stand up on things we even agree with? because of the visual of showing him standing up behind the president might be too much for many Republicans to bear. And that I think essentially answers the question as to where the GOP base is now. Is this is a party that is so anti-democratic, you know, so hyper-partisanized to its own worldview that it's willing to shift its own policies and positions or step away from them as they did in the immigration debate simply because they're not coming from their side of the aisle. And that's a dangerous place for democracy to be in, but it's also not illustrative of what a functioning political party is.
The Republicans chose Senator Katie Britt from Alabama, who's 42 years old, to give the official Republican response. She did that from her kitchen. Let's hear just a little bit of what she had to say, and then I want to ask you all about that.
We have the worst inflation in 40 years and the highest credit card debt in our nation's history. Let that sink in. Hardworking families are struggling to make ends meet today. And with soaring mortgage rates and sky-high childcare cost, they're also struggling to how to plan for tomorrow.
Chris Cattalago, what do you make of the Republicans choosing her to give the response and then the contents and the style that she used in delivering it?
Yeah, certainly being in her early 40s, there was a huge contrast in age there and experience with the president. You know, the issues she hit on are things that both Republicans will be running on, but there are also things you do hear from not only Republican voters, independent voters being on the ground in Nevada for the caucus and the primary, being out in South Carolina. These are some of the things you hear brought up right away from folks, the concerns they have, hitting on the economy. One of the reasons that there's been a lag, obviously, in how folks feel about the economy, regardless of where the market is and regardless of where these jobs reports are, is just the price of what they're paying for gas, what they're paying at the grocery store. And so hitting on those things, you know, Biden's best hope on those is clearly that things start to turn around as we get closer to November. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of criticism of her over-the-top performance of it. There are clips out there of her speaking normally, and that was certainly seemed to be a distraction for folks when they watched this, regardless of what the content was, that she was sort of overly dramatic in delivering this. We hear every year about how difficult giving that speech is. You're in a studio type room and speaking to a camera. Often it's somebody like we've seen in the past, Bobby Jindal, Marco Rubio, young Kennedy, the former congressman from Massachusetts, folks who have not been on that stage very often. And so that adds to the degree of difficulty. They're giving this speech in basically a quiet room, having to respond to a president who's usually been around for quite a bit longer. And so, you know, when the story is more about the awkward delivery or the chapstick or the drinking too much water, it often just gets kind of mocked and forgotten very quickly. And then, you know, next time we'll hear about it is probably in another litany of missed opportunities.
Catherine Lucie, yeah. There was some talk, or is perhaps some talk, that Senator Britt is being considered as a vice presidential running mate for Donald Trump. Do you think she helped herself or hurt herself last night?
You know, I learned long ago not to try and predict how Donald Trump is going to make moves on such things. And I do think broadly, she did a couple things. I mean, she really laid out a lot of the Republican messaging we're going to see this year in terms of the border, raising concerns about crime, about prices, and you know, putting a lot of that in the context of being, you know, a mother of young children. And she also delivered a pretty clear message on in vitro fertilization, you know, following that state Supreme Court ruling in Alabama that embryos could be considered children under state law, which has created a lot of issues around families trying to use IVF in the state. And Democrats have really seized on that as an example of, you know, reproductive health care that Republicans could target. And so she said in her remarks that, you know, she supports supports IVF, says she wants to help parents bring life into the world. So I do think that was another, you know, piece of her message that they wanted to make very clear.
Some comments from listeners. Paul writes, I forced myself to listen to the Republican response, but soon found myself wondering whether Senator Britt could complete two sentences in a row without lying or at least severely distorting the facts. Uses of phrases like runaway inflation when the rate has been consistently dropping for months makes me wonder whether these people have any connection to reality at all. And then Michael tweets, Biden has been slapped down by the Supreme Court several times now. He doesn't seem to know the limits on federal power. How does he expect to, quote, codify Roe v. Wade when the Supreme Court has already foreclosed the possibility in Dobbs? All right, let's go to the phones now. And Eli in Sebastopol, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? I have a comment and a question. First comment was just about the rebuttal. You know, I thought that was almost nauseatingly hypocritical, just because she stole a couple lines from Biden, one of them being somebody missing at the kitchen table, which, you know, I lost somebody to COVID in my family, my direct family, and millions of people did. So I would think that would be hurtful to a lot of people, that they seem to only care about things that are on their side of the aisle. And, you know, they also stole the Say Her Name campaign from Black Lives Matter, and they could care less about any of the people in that campaign, anybody killed in the mass shooting. So it's just them very much preaching to the choir on their side. And my question, Biden didn't really bring it up, not surprised, but I have Arab American friends who are not going to vote in the next election because of Israel and Palestine. And I understand the protest vote 100%. I think it sent a message. I do not understand at all not voting in November, because your option is somebody who's, you know, wants a Muslim ban, you know, not been friendly to Arab Americans or Muslim people, and is probably the most staunch supporter of Israel in the history of the presidency. So, you know, I know the dissatisfaction with the, you know, the two parties. I was a Bernie Sanders guy.
Yeah.
I
mean, let me put that point to Chris Catalago. I mean, it is one thing to make a protest vote in the primary. How hard do you think it'll be for Biden to get those folks not just to vote for him, but to maybe to vote at all?
I think that the Biden campaign will get to that point. They will be making the point that the caller is making and drawing a sharp contrast that if you don't turn out, you might get Trump. Right now, there's a thought that people could be exercising, like you say, a protest vote. They could be trying to send a message. Certainly in Michigan, that was the case, and even some of these other states. I think what you need to look at is the difference between, say, a Michigan and maybe a South Carolina. Obviously, South Carolina was not a competitive primary, not a real competitive primary for Biden, but that was really the state that launched him. And the numbers, the turnout numbers were not great for Biden. And so you got to look at how much of the base is turning out. Biden will start putting the screws in the campaign will. To voters and drawing that contrast. But I think there's a sensitivity there, right? I mean, if people want to hear from you over issues around Israel and Palestine, you know, they do expect, obviously, the situation to change a whole lot from now until November. So expect them to go in that direction. But it's a little early right now. And the question will just be how many of those folks come home.
Yeah, exactly. And also, of course, what is actually happening on the ground in Gaza? Lots of time yet to figure that out. But of course, President Biden can't make Prime Minister Netanyahu do anything he doesn't want to do. All right, we're going to continue our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Give us your thoughts about the speech last night and the reaction to it. 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can find us on all the social media channels. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer in this hour for Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this hour from Mina Kim, talking about President Biden's State of the Union speech last night. What did you think? Did you hear what you wanted to hear? Were you impressed with his vigor? Or perhaps did it fall short in some way? Give us a call. Let us know. 866-733-6786. Or you can reach us on all the social media channels, Twitter, X, Instagram, or Discord. We're at KQED Forum. And we're going to go now to San Jose. And Carol, you're next. Welcome.
Hi. I'm a retired speech-language pathologist, and I just wanted to say that Biden had a significant problem of stuttering in his youth. He still rarely has difficulty starting a word. That is not a problem. It is not memory or old age. In fact, he did an excellent job last night in his State of the Union speech. That's just what I wanted to say.
All right. I appreciate that. And certainly a lot of folks were looking for that. He did, you know, stumble a couple times, but, you know, he spoke for well over an hour. And of course, you know, Catherine, the president's age is a big issue. He's 81. And I want to ask you about that. But let's play a short clip of him, you know, kind of making light of that.
I know it may not look like it, but I've been around a while. When you get to be my age, certain things become clearer than ever. I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation.
Catherine, you know, as the caller, Carol, said, the president has long dealt with a stutter. It's compounded, of course, by his age. But what do you make of, you know, he of course, had a lot of energy. Did he put to rest, at least for now, questions about whether he has what it takes to both wage a vigorous campaign and then, you know, serve for four more years?
Certainly that was his goal. He came in hot. He clearly was eager to do this. There were, I think it was like 80 exclamation points in the speech. So he was clearly prepped to go hard. He was yelling or he was loud a lot. He was really looking for those moments where he could banter or joust with Republicans. So he really wanted to show that he was sort of, you know, fighting Biden, as some people call it. But his age is a real concern for voters. We see this again and again and again in polling. When you go out and talk to people in these key states, people are very worried about it and worried about his abilities and whether he can serve for another 4 years. So certainly a strong and sort of vigorous performance, you know, could help with some of those voters, but he still has months of campaigning to go, and people are going to need to see him, you know, on the campaign trail, you know, doing events. They're going to want to see how he handles those things as well, I think.
Mike Madrid, how would you grade the media in covering this issue of Biden's age, and also as it relates to former President Donald Trump, who, of course, has had his own problems, mispronouncing names, forgetting his wife's name, calling, confusing Nancy Pelosi with other people. And so, you know, he's not immune to these memory problems either.
No, I mean, look, we're dealing with the two oldest candidates in the history of the Republic running for the presidency of the United States, and they're very legitimate concerns. I don't think that the media has been overly critical of Joe Biden. I do think it's an issue. I don't think it's as central an issue as I think a lot of people are worried and concerned about, particularly in Democratic politics. I think that there's an overly hand-wringing, you know, situation where Democrats, I think, are worried about some of the polling, and they're looking for as many weaknesses in their candidates as possible. Did Joe Biden put that to rest, last night? He certainly went a long way of demonstrating that all of the concerns and weaknesses that some of what should be his greatest allies are overwrought. They are overblown. But it's not unfair to ask that question. As a professional, you know, political campaign operative, I would suggest that this is not going to be a determinative characteristic that people are focused. The voters are going to be focused on. It is a concern, but it's probably third, fourth, fifth of an issue, especially as the campaign begins to unfold and this abstract notion idea of Trump versus Biden becomes more real, more existential.
You agree with that, Chris?
I think certainly in the Biden camp, they recognize this issue around his age. They recognize that it really drives coverage. And of all the things that they're dealing with, it is certainly one of the big ones that they can't do anything about. He's going to be the age that he is, and you can't change that over the next 8 months. I think one way, there was a more extended riff, some of these lines he's used before, but one of the ones that I think you're really going to hear a lot more of is this line that it's not so much the age of the president or his age, but the age of their ideas. And he basically said he wants to take the country forward, and Republicans are basically looking to strip away rights via the Supreme Court, via Congress, via executive order, and that it doesn't really matter. And in fact, you know, might be an advantage, he would argue, having seen the country, having been, you know, he went out of his way to point out that he was born during World War II. And so that's really, I think, where he's going to go with this. He'll probably use some moments to make light of it, but try to talk about the upsides of that age, and also try to say that he's someone who is looking forward and Trump wants to look back.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we're going to go to Palo Alto next. And actually, I'm sorry, we're going to go to Santa Rosa. And Gary, hi there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. My problem is the genocide of the Palestinian people. They're gentle. They're very kind people. They're generous. And so many of us are trying to get the attention, I think, for all the good that Biden has done. His legacy is becoming this war. And I think that he needs to focus more on changing that and distancing himself between himself and Netanyahu, who is an extremist.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. It's just very upsetting for me.
Yeah, understood. Thank you so much for that comment. Catherine, Lucy, this is a tough one for Biden. It sort of reminds me a little bit, of course, it's very different, but the issue with the border, because you've got different Democratic constituencies that feel very differently about what's happening in the Middle East with Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians. Sort of as, you know, we've heard some critics of Latinos, including Senator Alex Padilla, on what the Democrats were willing to give into Republicans about border security. So how tough is this for the president to navigate?
These are tough issues. I mean, there's a reality that you become president with a whole lot of things that you want to do. And then there's a lot of things that you are forced to deal with that you wouldn't have chosen. And this war in the Middle East is certainly a really hard one for the president. And it is really exposing these divisions in his party. And it's not just with, you know, Arab Americans. We see young people, college campuses, you know, there are a lot of folks in the party who are, you know, expressing a lot of concern about Gaza. But you also, of course, have, other people in the party who have, you know, been longtime supporters of Israel. So it really is a tough division and a very difficult line for him to walk. And I think the thinking in his camp is, as you look to November, you hope that the situation on the ground has changed by then, that they have made some progress towards some kind of pause or ceasefire or move forward, that you're not in the same situation in October that you are today. But this is a really challenging one for him.
Well, it's interesting too, because you know, we heard Vice President Harris call for a ceasefire, kind of the furthest that the administration had gone. We saw her and Secretary of State Blinken meet with Benny Gantz, who is a political opponent of Netanyahu, as did, I think, Great Britain's Foreign Minister David Cameron. Does that signal to you like an effort to try to isolate Netanyahu in some way, or maybe even, I don't know, push the country toward, you know, that coalition falling apart and into elections? Because obviously Netanyahu is not a friend. He and Biden have very different agendas right now. I was putting that to you, Catherine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
More of a speech than a question.
not at all. These are, as we say, these are hard issues to for the president and for us to talk about. You know, certainly he is trying to, I think, engage with other foreign leaders. They're trying to figure out how to deal with Netanyahu. I think the president, his frustration with the situation and with Netanyahu has become more and more clear and more public. And so I think that has been a shift we have seen over the last couple of months. And so we're going to have to see how that unfolds in the coming weeks as they continue to try and work towards some kind of, humanitarian pause deal.
All right, let's go back to the phones now, and we'll go to Reno and Carol. You're next. Welcome.
Hi. I was going to miss the speech last night, but I caught the last, say, 10 minutes. And I actually was rather impressed with Biden, and I was happy that he presented himself the way he did. I think what we're missing, too, though, is we're failing to compare Trump and Biden's age. They're very close together. And, you know, I wish people would start talking maybe a little bit more about that. And maybe we could eventually get some newer candidates, the younger people in. That would be great.
Yeah.
I switched over to Republican this year just because I wanted to vote in their primary. And so I went in and I voted for Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
And of course she did not.
Well, let me ask Mike Madrid about that, because obviously Nikki Haley has dropped out. She did not endorse former President Trump. Where do you see her role going forward, and who does she speak for, and where do her voters go?
Well, I think it's great that your caller called in with that, because more than half of Nikki Haley's voters were anti-Trump voters. They're not pro-Nikki Haley. And that data actually kind of screws up the real primary question of who's going to actually win the election in November, which is how many Republicans are actually going to not vote for Donald Trump and will vote for Joe Biden. And so there were a lot of voters, independents and Democrats, crossing over. And the exit polling data would suggest that more than half of her support was not Republican was more anti-Trump than it was pro-Haley. I think it's more likely that she endorses Trump late into the stretch than otherwise would be the case, which I think functionally ends whatever it is that she aspires to do. But she's kind of in this conundrum that so many of us that in the Republican Party who have spoken up against the president face. That the real decision of where this movement goes is going to be entirely determinative on the outcome of the elections. If Donald Trump loses, and I think that's where this is headed, then I think there will be a big existential question about the splitting up of the Republican Party, which I think is extremely likely. Mm. I don't think that the Republican Party will continue as we've known it. If he does win, then I think obviously it's a very different consideration.
Yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer in for Mina Kim. And let's go back to the phones now. And our next stop is Palo Alto. And Mary, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I want to say, number one, Biden did an amazing and wonderful, great job last night. He hit on, as far as I was concerned, all of the issues that someone my age, who is now a senior citizen, are concerned about, as well as the same kind of struggle to support young people who also have incredibly expensive medical costs and not enough money to send their kids to school and things like that. Those things are extremely important for our country. So I wanted to, say I think the points he made with respect to that were great. I have two other comments.
Okay, quickly, if you would. We're almost at the end of the hour.
I understand. I think the Speaker of the House did agree. He shook his head yes several times. The last comment I have to make is we are never going to be able to fix the border problem until we fix whatever's wrong with the countries that the people who are escaping to our border come from.
Yeah, absolutely. The issues are complicated. People are coming here because they are escaping crime and a lack of economic opportunity, drug cartels, and all the rest. A very, very complicated problem. I think most people understand that. Christopher Catalago, we had an election this week here in California. We're still counting ballots, but the turnout was quite low, perhaps historically low for a presidential primary. What do you think that says, if anything, about who's going to turn out in November?
I think it's a little bit hard to say. I'd be curious what Mike would think, in part because we had a lot of folks who wanted to turn out for Donald Trump, and there just was not a lot of action driving turnout at the top of the ticket, given Biden's incumbency. And so we ended up with sort of the most loyal Democratic down the line, 5 out of 5 voters who are older, tend to be white, so a less diverse electorate, an older electorate. And we saw the results of that. Adam Schiff, Steve Garvey, the Republican, advancing in the Senate race. We saw that down the line in all the down ballot races as well. And so I don't know that you can make predictions based on that number, based on what we're going to see in a general with Biden and Trump and all the stakes that that's going to carry. And so I would still think if you look at from 2016 to 2020, 2020 just kind of blew the roof off of the numbers in terms of turnout. And so I would probably look more toward a November general election being one where folks will turn out. The other result, obviously, of this low turnout primary was the fact that it's looking like if it passes, it'll just squeak by a huge priority of the governor's Prop 1,
yeah,
which seems to have almost fallen victim and still may to that low turnout.
Yeah, just about 32,000 votes separating yes from no, yes leading just barely last time I checked. Mike Madrid, what about you? What do you think this week's turnout says about November, and what do Democrats have to do to get that turnout up?
Well, I think Chris is right. I think that
I know you're not advising Democrats, by the way. At least I don't think you are.
But obviously, and you're asking a great question. Let me say this. I think we're going to have, if not historically high turnout, we're going to have very close to that. I believe that we are in a period of extended high turnout elections, which are indicative of voters being keenly aware that there's an existential threat to the country on both sides. If Democrats believe that the end of the Republic is coming, if Republicans win, Republicans are equally convicted on the other side, that tends to drive very high turnout. I would say this, the old idea of Democrats benefiting from higher turnout is no longer proving true. We are seeing that all across the country. We saw it here in California in 2020. We saw it nationally where Joe Biden won, but Republicans picked up the House. Speaking with Dave Wasserman earlier this morning from the Cook Report, we're seeing this type of behavior across the country. And that's a part of the shifting coalitions in both parties. Higher turnout elections are increasingly benefiting Republicans.
Yeah, really quick, Catherine Lucy, final thought.
I mean, obviously, I think that the election is going to play out in, you know, 6 battleground states, and we're going to have to see what turnout looks like in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, yeah, Pennsylvania, Arizona.
Yeah.
Those are always really the places that are going to decide this.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, we are out of time, but thank you all so much. Catherine Lucy, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Christopher Catalago from Politico, Mike Madrid, Republican strategist, and earlier in the hour, Congressman Ro Khanna. This hour of Forum is produced by Caroline Smith, Mark Nieto, Tessa Paoli, and Dan Zoll. Jennifer Ng is our engagement producer. Francesca Fenzi is our digital community producer. Susie Britton is our lead producer. Our engineers this week were Danny Bringer, Brendan Willard, Chris Beal, and Jim Bennett. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Mina Kim. Thank you so much for listening to Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.